Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with your hosts, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Connell Smith and Elliot Watson.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this episode of the Versus History Podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick O'Shaughnessy at History Chappie on social media. Today, we are delighted to be joined by our special guest, historian and author, Mr. Damian Lewis, who joined us previously on the podcast, I think back in November 2020 for episode 106 about his previous book, SAS Band of Brothers. But today he's here to talk to us all about his new book, SAS Great Escapes. Welcome back, Damian. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you. Brilliant. Lovely to be back.
The audience loved the last one, and I'm sure this will be no different. The last book was an absolute tour de force. From what I've seen of this new one, having a look at the PDF copy, it looks like another absolute barn burner. So thank you very much indeed for A, writing it, and B, for coming to talk to us all about it. So whilst we're with that, then tell us all about your new book, SAS Great Escapes. Why did you write it, Damian? And how did you go about researching it? Because I think that's really important, not just, you know, why did you write it? Because military history comes with its own challenges and positives as well. How did you go about researching it?
Yeah, well, the story came to me in a kind of like number of episodes. I mean, basically, in writing a number of World War II books over the last 7 or 8 years, I came across these absolutely amazing stories of individual SAS members in World War II executing these just incredible, extraordinary, daring, brave, courageous, mind-blowing escapes. And very often those were kind of not germane to the main story I was working on. So I kind of filed them away as just incredible stories to return to. And so eventually I chose, you know, a selection of those escapes, which I think are some of the most incredible stories from the Second World War of that spirit to get back to your line so you can continue the fight in freedom's cause. And that's really how the book came together. And then in terms of researching it, well, you know, it's been more of a challenge than it may have been, because obviously we've had on again, off again lockdowns for the last year or more. And the archives have been closed for quite a lot of the time. That's not just here in the UK. That's everywhere, you know, America, France. So I've had to get in and out of the archives when I can. So that's been a bit of a guerrilla operation, as you can imagine.
I bet.
Yeah, I mean, luckily I managed to get everything I needed. And also, of course, I've had sterling help from some of the families of those whose stories are told, you know, and, you know, just for example, in the case of the Langton story, Thomas Langton, who escaped in North Africa after the raid on Tobruk, you know, in his case, his family gave me access to his private archive and papers, and there were diaries from his escape, and those kind of things are invaluable, and especially over the last 18 months, 2 years, when we've been faced with these, you know, seesaw lockdowns.
Of course, never probably a more difficult time to write a book since the advent of the internet than during the COVID pandemic. So credit to you. Okay, it's a bit of a silly question for a history teacher and history podcaster to ask, but why does this history deserve to be brought to the spotlight now? And what can readers expect to learn if and when they buy the book, Damian?
You know, that's a great question. I was thinking about this, and actually, you know, it's a bit of a left field answer, but, you know, indulge me if you may. I think we're all in need of uplifting stories. I think we're all in need of uplifting stories about survival against the odds. Let's be frank about it.
Of course.
You know, and I started writing the book long before the pandemic. I mean, I started researching it years ago when I was coming across the earliest escape stories. But it just seemed the time was right to write it and publish it now. You know, we have all been through a tough year, you know, the toughest in my living memory, and I'm sure for many, many listeners. And it's just, you know, it's uplifting and rewarding and gratifying to read about these incredible individuals going through the most horrendous experiences you can imagine in captivity, in German or Italian captivity in World War II, but never giving up, knowing that, you know, the fight in Freedom's cause was the most important thing, and that they had, come what may, they had to get back to Allied lines and rejoin the fight. And it's a really interesting aspect of the story, is that in a lot of the cases, you know, they're driven almost by this guilt that their comrades, their brothers in arms, are out there, you know, fighting the good fight and losing their lives and getting injured and you know, operating behind the lines on repeated raiding operations, and they are in captivity, languishing in you know, comparative comfort and safety. And so often they're driven by that guilt of the need to get back to their units and get back to the fight.
Amen to that. Thanks, Damien. Okay, the next question, then, it's quite a long one, but stick with me. The book charts the incredible lost history of the SAS a year before Colonel David Stirling founded the unit, the fledgling Special Air Service, which was already operational at Churchill's insistence. It chronicles the story of the first ever raid by that SAS unit and Britain's first ever airborne operation in February 1941, Operation Colossus, which I'd never heard of until I read the book. We would love to know more about that as an hors d'oeuvre. Could you tell us a little bit more, just to paint the picture without obviously giving away all the story of the book?
Yeah, so literally days after Dunkirk, after you know, retreat and defeat on the French continent, Churchill demanded of his chiefs of staff that they raise that they were termed then, we're talking June 1940, the special duty volunteers. And these were volunteers to wage special forces warfare as we know it today, but something that had never been tried by the British military or any military at the time. So they were called the commandos in their earliest iteration. But the commandos were a seaborne, landborne raiding force. Churchill had been very impressed by the Germans' use of airborne forces, the Fallschirmjäger, early on in the war, and he decreed that he wanted 5,000 to 10,000 airborne troops raised and trained and ready for war, you know, by the turn of the year. And of course, despite all the challenges, lack of airframes, experience, uniforms, training facilities, that was got underway. And because they were known as the special service volunteers, the land and seaborne forces, they inserted the word air into special service volunteers. And so you ended up with the Special Air Service volunteers. That was, you know, September 1940. And in due course, you know, several hundred were trained. You know, we had no airborne experience whatsoever. And so they had to be tried and tested in combat. And Operation Colossus was the first ever airborne raid by Allied forces, by British forces, and it went out deep into Italy to carry out one of the most daring and audacious and controversial raids of the entire war.
Thank you, Damien. Now, I must admit, the remainder of the questions are courtesy of the Versus History listeners and my brother Fraser O'Shaughnessy, who was in the forces. So I've had to call on the collective wisdom of the listeners and my own brother for this. So let's kick off with them. Far better than my questions, I must say. Was there a common theme amongst the escapes, Damien, and their method or enabling? Or was it some ad hoc individual ingenuity and sheer bloody mindedness?
I think a common theme developed over the years of the war, and because every escapee, you know, the first thing that happened when they got back to the UK was they were, it was called an interrogation, it was a debrief basically, so a very detailed debrief so that, you know, the military could learn all the lessons from these escapees. So as that body of evidence you know, was drawn up, and as MI9, you know, the escape factory, the escape specialists imbued that body of evidence and then worked with SOE, Special Operations Executive, to refine the kind of equipment men could be sent into the field with, hidden equipment, hidden compasses, hidden in buttons, you know, the kind of equipment that could be sent in disguised in Red Cross food parcels to help them escape. So maps disguised as handkerchiefs and all these kind of very ingenious escape aids. As that body of evidence and body of materials was developed through the war, there was an evolution. But in terms of the common theme from the start, well, it goes back to, you know, the founding precepts of David Stirling when he put together the SAS officially in North Africa. And basically, some of his founding precepts were merit above rank, a classless society, humour, and the relentless pursuit of excellence. And because of that, you tended to have a certain type of individual who would be drawn to those kind of precepts and who would survive the selection criteria. And that kind of individual was the kind of person who, you know, bearing in mind the merit above rank concept, what was the merit above rank concept based upon really? It was the idea that if you were a small body of men deployed behind the lines and your commanding officers were killed or captured, maybe you were the only man left alive, but you had the self-determination and the self-confidence to carry out that raid no matter what your rank. That was the idea behind merit above rank. Now, imagine that transferred into a captivity situation. It wouldn't matter what your rank was. It wouldn't matter necessarily what mission you had been captured on. You knew that your duty was to escape and that you... that is despite your rank or your background or the fact that you may have felt marooned, as they often did, in a country where they didn't speak the language, they were not, you know, they're in hostile terrain, it was your duty, and you were capable of escaping and getting back to Allied lines. And that's really what underpins all of the escapes, that relentless and unyielding attitude.
We could all do with a bit of that in our lives. Thank you very, very much, Damien. Okay, the next question, and it's a bit cruel, I think, because all the seven escapes that you've written about are pretty much masterpieces, but I'm going to put the question to you anyway. What was the biggest single masterpiece you uncovered while researching and writing SAS Great Escapes? A piece of utter genius where someone perhaps overcame massive odds, although I think they all did, to walk away from captivity?
You know, it's a tough question, but one that does stand out for me, and it does so because of the ramifications it had all the way through the war and after the war. So Quentin Hughes, lieutenant, who was deployed to Italy in 43 and to blow up an airbase, he and his commanding officer, they're the only two men from their patrol who actually get through to the airbase. It's just prior to the Anzio landing, so they're there to stop the German reconnaissance planes getting into the air to actually rumble the Anzio landings, a crucial mission. So only the two of them get through to the base, and they both get onto it and they plant their charges, but there's a premature explosion and they're both very badly injured. Commanding officer is killed, Hughes is captured. But during Hughes's capture, and basically very badly injured, so he's in hospital being treated by German medics, but from the very get-go, he's menaced by the Gestapo, and they basically say to him, words to the effect, you're not a prisoner of war, you're an illegal combatant, and we have orders from the Führer that you're only to be kept alive for long enough to question you before you will be killed out of hand. Now, Hughes doesn't know at the time if that's an interrogation technique or an idle threat or if it's actually real. And it's due to the sympathy and ingenuity of the German doctors and another German officer who's held in the hospital with him that Hughes actually manages to escape. And then his escape story is remarkable. I mean, his ability to get through the Italian mountains and make the offshore rendezvous in the vessel they managed to find to escape, shepherding a load of very senior officers as he goes, is a really incredible story. But the point about it is, the reason why it stands out is that when he gets back to the UK, Hughes is debriefed by Major Eric Bill Barkworth, who was the SAS intelligence officer. And Hughes tells Barkworth in no uncertain terms, and the report that he and Barkworth put together is very detailed and very powerful. He tells him all about this, what became known as Hitler's commando order, this execution order put in place by Hitler that anybody captured behind the lines, any special duty volunteers, any special forces would be only kept for alive for long enough to torture them and interrogate them and then executed out of hand. And that's raised to a very high level, but it's kind of dismissed by the high command, and they can't believe that the German military would be capable of entertaining or executing such an order. And the SAS don't concur. And Barkworth in particular, and Colonel Franks, commander of 2 SAS, do not concur. They have noticed the disappearance of any number of captured SAS, the inexplicable disappearance of them. And after Hughes's return, they start to realise that what's happening, as Hughes has warned, is that they are being disappeared into what Hitler had decreed as the Nacht und Nebel, the night and fog. So this was, Nacht und Nebel meant that you would literally disappear without trace. Your family, your loved ones, your country, your military unit would never, ever know what had happened to you. And of course, that led towards the end of the war to Colonel Franks and Bach the forming the SAS Nazi hunting, the SAS war crimes investigation team, which would hunt down the perpetrators of the commander order, those who murdered the captured SAS and SOE and other special forces operators right through to 1948.
Thank you, Damien. I think the next question is my favourite because it's going to get you to look at this whole story from the complete opposite perspective. So it's a scenario. It's 1942. You're the commandant of an Axis prisoner of war camp. And these chaps are your prisoners. Damien, what do you have to do to keep them locked up successfully for the duration of the war?
Pray would be my suggestion. I mean, you know, if you read some of these stories, you know, there was no way, there was no way to keep these guys contained. I'll give you an example. So, In Greece in 1940, Major Farron, Roy Farron, you know, legendary figure of the SAS, is held in captivity, and he's so badly injured. So it's a hospital prisoner of war camp, but it's still a prisoner of war camp. You know, it's got barbed wire fences and watchtowers and machine gun nests. And anyway, it's in Athens, and he's so badly injured. Very badly injured in the leg and the thigh during the Battle of Crete, and he's so badly injured that when a group of these prisoners break out one storm racked night, they deliberately leave Farron behind, although Farron's part of the escape committee, because they know he will refuse to get left behind, but they suspect he's too badly injured to even walk, let alone make the escape, and so they leave him behind. When he finds out they've escaped, he's absolutely devastated. But completely undaunted, you know, in due course, not long thereafter, he himself throws away his crutch, crawls under the wire, and manages to sneak his way into the nearest Greek streets. He's practically naked by this time, having lost all his clothes on the barbed wire, gets taken to a house by a Greek lady, and that's the start of the most epic and incredible escape story that you can imagine. I mean, so many times they are on the brink of death and they get through. And I don't know what one could have done to stop these individuals escaping. You know, it's a hard question to answer, because you were talking about, let's be frank about it, you were talking about individuals who knew they were facing death but would rather lose their lives than give up trying to escape. And that makes it very hard.
Certainly does. Wouldn't envy their job. Prisoners like that you do not need, I'm sure. Okay, the next question is about, I suppose, the motivations, the push and pull factors behind them trying to escape. So what were their motivations, David? I'm sure it's different in each case, but I'm sure there may be some common themes. So was it the treatment in the prison camp? Was it them missing the luxuries and delights of home? Was it a belief in what they were fighting for? Or was it more due to the esprit de corps of the SAS mixed with their training, basically saying, what, so you think you'll keep us locked up? Best of luck with that. What drove them to try to escape?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, the single greatest motivating factor, as I say, maybe guilt isn't the right word. Maybe responsibility is the right word. Maybe it's duty. But you know, in all the accounts I've read, the single overriding factor, you've got to imagine yourself being in the prisoner of war camp and a prisoner turns up who's got news of your regiment, of the SAS in operations. He's got news of fatalities, friends of yours who've died. And you've been sat there for weeks, maybe months, languishing in a POW camp, unable to fight, unable to stand shoulder to shoulder with your brothers in arms. That's what drove them to escape. Yes, you know, there was the undying urge to fight the good fight, to fight the fight in freedom's cause, to vanquish the Nazi threat. These things were very, very real and very true. But actually, what really drove these individuals to escape was the need to rejoin their units and do their duty alongside their comrades and their brothers in arms. And, you know, you can see at times when they're at their lowest ebb on these escapes, and they very often are, you know, frozen to the bone in the Apennine Mountains, starving, surrounded by the enemy, seemingly hopeless. And so often in those situations, it's the determination to get back to their fellow fighters and rejoin the fight that drives them onwards and means that they do not give up and they get through.
Very powerful answer. Thanks, Damien. Okay, the final question from us. It follows our previous interview with you, because we had a number of listeners from around the world get in touch to inquire about, you know, how they go about writing their own military history specifically. So what advice would you give to the next budding Damien Lewis out there, or the next Max Hastings or Anthony Beaver? What do you wish, Damien, that you'd known about researching and writing military history 10 years ago that you now know that you'd like to impart to our listeners that would like to follow in your footsteps?
I think the most important thing is that you write about what you care about and what you're impassioned about. That's absolutely key. You can always tell a book of military history that's been written by somebody who absolutely thrills to their subject and has a relationship and a connection to those people they write about. And I always do. You know, in every single one of the great escapes, for example, in SAS Great Escapes, by the end of researching and writing their story, I knew that individual. You know, I cared about that individual's fate. You know, I was gunning for them to get through. And I think you need to engage with your subject matter in that way. I think that's really important. And that shines through to your reader. And then the other really key aspect is research. Get into the archives, you know. You will be amazed what you can find. You will be amazed what has been kept for posterity. And I'm not just talking about the British archives. I'm talking in France. I'm talking in Germany, for example, Italy and America. You know, you start digging, you will be absolutely amazed what you can find. I mean, I've just got a file because the archives have just reopened in the UK properly at Kew. I've just managed to retrieve a file that I've been after for months and months on end. It's a special operations executive file about several months of seaborne operations in the Mediterranean. It is the most amazing material you could ever read. I cannot believe they actually carried out these operations. They are so outrageous. You know, talk about the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare being set up to break all the rules of war. They are so outrageous. Such rule breaking, such brilliant opportunism embodied in those raids. And the files have been kept for posterity and they're there in the archives. I couldn't believe it. So, you know, dig deep. If you have a story you really care passionately about and you really want to write and you really want to tell, dig deep in the archives and reach out to any survivors, because you'll generally find, in fact, you'll invariably find that those people whose parents or grandparents served in, or uncles or aunts served in the Second World War, they are always so pleased to have someone telling their story, because, you know, these tales, it's great to bring them to the light of day.
Thank you so much, Damien. Okay, well, that concludes my questions. Is there anything that you'd like to finish off with, or is there anything that my questions didn't give you the chance to discuss that you wanted to mention to our readers about your brand new book, SAS Great Escapes?
Well, I just want to add, I think one of the really nice things about this book is bear in mind, when these SAS figures escape, they often do so in the company of lots of other individuals who are not SAS. These, you know, they can be, and often that they're different nationalities. You've got Americans in there, Canadians in there, you know, Italian partisans in there. So this is a team effort, and it cuts across lots of different units and lots of different nationalities. When you're in a prisoner of war camp, you know, that's a new brotherhood you've forged there. And so I love the fact that these stories are international, and they cut across, as I say, so many different fighting units from World War II. So, you know, read it in that spirit, because it really is a book which brings so many different nationalities, different units together in one cause.
A fantastic book it is too. Now, if you want to get in touch with Damien, listeners, Damien is on Twitter. I'm sure he won't mind me sharing his handle. It's author D. Lewis. When's the book out, Damien? Is it out for general sale yet, or is it coming out shortly?
No, it comes out at the end of the month, so you can pre-order it. But yeah, you know, it's a kind of story that, you know, should keep you on the edge of your seats as you're reading it. I mean, you know, these escapees did the most extraordinary things in the most difficult situations, in the depths of harm's way.
And there's an Audible book out as well for those that are commuting, yes. Right?
Yeah, so there's an Audible book, and also it's available as an ebook, I think, already. So on those, you know, all those formats are available, and I think the ebook and audiobook are already out there.
Thank you so much, Damien, for coming to join us versus history to discuss your new book, SAS Great Escapes. Always a pleasure having you, and I've got a feeling we'll be seeing you when you publish your next one. So thank you very much indeed for spending time with us. On behalf of me, my co-editors and the listeners, we're very, very grateful for your time. Listeners, it's a fantastic book. Go and buy that. Damien, thank you so much.
Thank you. Always a pleasure and great to talk to you.
Yeah, speak soon. Bye, Damien.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Versus History podcast. Visit us at www.versushistory.com and follow us at Versus History on Twitter and Instagram. You can download all episodes from iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or from wherever you get your podcasts.